Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly Higher Education Report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us about the effort by some American lawmakers and others to convince colleges to offer classes for little or no cost. Then you will hear Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Anna Mateo will tell us about American English expressions related to presidential elections in the United States. Tomorrow, Monday, February 20th, is President's Day in America, a federal holiday. And finally, as we do every Sunday, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, Steve Ember continues the story of the presidency of Ronald Reagan. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So let's get started. Here's higher education correspondent Pete Musto.
Some people say the United States higher education system is the best in the world. But the cost of a college education in the U.S. can be very high. About 70% of students graduate with some debt. In 2014, the total amount of that debt in the U.S. reached about $1.2 trillion. Norway, Finland, Germany, Mexico, and Brazil are very different countries. But they all have one thing in common. Citizens can attend public universities for little to no cost. That is why some American lawmakers are looking to other countries as models for change. During his 2016 presidential campaign, Senator Bernie Sanders said the U.S. needed to offer free college. Sanders' presidential campaign was unsuccessful, but he is not alone in the fight for free education. In 2014, Tennessee became the first state to provide free community college to recent high school graduates. Community colleges are smaller public schools that usually offer two-year degree programs. The schools also provide general education classes at low cost to students who plan to transfer to a four-year college. Earlier this month, Tennessee reported a 30% increase in the number of students attending community college for the first time. Oregon also has a program like Tennessee's. In fall of 2016, the Oregon program paid for at least part of the cost for 6,745 students to attend community college. The idea of free college is spreading in the U.S. Last month, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced his own plan. It centers on families making less than $125,000 a year. It would permit their children to attend the state's public universities for free. Officials say Cuomo's plan could cost as much as $163 million per year by 2019. Richard Vedder is director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity, a research organization. He feels some New Yorkers may not like an increase in taxes to pay for Cuomo's plan and could move to different states. He also thinks it is fair to ask students to pay for some of the cost of college.
First of all, the students are the primary beneficiaries of the college education. Most of them, after college, will earn a good deal more income than they did before going to college. A lot of the students who go to college can afford to pay tuition. The tuition fee is not an obstacle that keeps them from attending, so asking them to pay tuition fees seems to be reasonable since they are getting a high return on the investment.
Vedder says offering free education at public universities could also hurt competition. Vedder says it could make private schools less appealing to students. In the case of Oregon, something similar may already be happening. Public university administrators in the state reported lower numbers of new students in 2016. This might suggest students are choosing the free community colleges over four-year degree programs. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, here's Anna Mateo.
And now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we explore common expressions in American English. Today, we talk about expressions related to the biggest contest in the United States, the election of the American president. Well, except for the first election, that was not much of a contest. On February 4th, 1789, all 69 members of Congress voted for George Washington. Supposedly, Washington didn't even want to be president. John Adams was the runner-up. So, according to the rules at the time, Adams became Washington's vice president. Elections these days are much harder to win. They can last for years and cost millions and millions of dollars. So, it is not surprising that there are many expressions to describe the race for the White House. That expression, in fact, is one of them. We often call political elections races, a word you probably know from sports. Many expressions we use for political campaigns are borrowed from sports competitions. In fact, sometimes we just cut to the chase and call the presidential election a horse race. If the race is close, we can say the candidates are neck and neck. This horse racing term means the two candidates are nearly tied in the polls, and a winner is difficult to predict. We call such a race, political or otherwise, a dead heat. In the early part of an election cycle, when a party is picking its nominee, usually many candidates are in the running. Sometimes, a candidate pulls away from the pack and becomes the clear favorite. These two terms also come from horse racing. So does down to the wire. In a horse race, the horses race to the finish and run through a wire as they cross the finish line. A presidential race that is down to the wire is very close. The only way to know the winner is to wait for all the votes to be counted. If a candidate wins the election by a large margin, that is to say, won by many, many votes, he or she has won hands down. We also say the race was a landslide. Or you could say the race was simply no contest. These expressions all mean a candidate won easily. But if a candidate loses an election by a big margin, we could say that campaign got blown out of the water, as if by a submarine torpedo. Or we might say simply that the candidate got crushed at the polls. More informally, we might also say the candidate got beat like a rug, which is visually very entertaining. Some candidates lose an election because they are unwilling to toe the party line. In other words, they refuse to go along with the rules and standards of their own political party. This may upset the candidate's base, the people who usually support that party. The opposite of towing the party line is reaching across the aisle. In the U.S., the two major parties are the Democrats and the Republicans. In this expression, the aisle refers to the actual physical walkway that divides the legislative halls. Members of the two parties sit on opposite sides. So, to reach across the aisle means to make an effort to negotiate with members who are not in your party. Many politicians win elections because of their willingness to work with members of the opposing party. On the other hand, some politicians lose for the same reason. Voters can sometimes be very difficult to predict. And that brings us to the end of another Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now we present The Making of a Nation. Steve Ember is here to continue the story of the presidency of Ronald Reagan.
Soon after his presidency began, there was an attempt on his life. A gunman shot President Reagan in March 1981. Doctors removed the bullet. He rested, regained his strength, and returned to the White House in 12 days. The new president wanted to reduce the size of the federal government. He and other conservative Republicans wanted less government interference in the lives of Americans. President Reagan won congressional approval for his plan to reduce income tax rates. Many Americans welcomed the plan. Others were concerned about its effects on the national debt. They saw taxes go down while defense spending went up. To save money, the Reagan administration decided to cut spending for some social programs. This pleased conservatives. Liberals, however, said it limited poor people's chances for good housing, healthcare, and education. President Reagan also had to make decisions about using military force in other countries. In 1983, he sent Marines to Lebanon. They joined other peacekeeping troops to help stop fighting among competing groups. On October 23rd, a truck carrying explosives bombed Marine housing at Beirut International Airport.
There was nothing in its appearance to suggest it was any different than the trucks or cars that were normally seen on and around the airport. But this one was different. At the wheel was a young man on a suicide mission. The truck carried some 2,000 pounds of explosives. But there was no way our Marine guards could know this. Their first warning that something was wrong came when the truck crashed through a series of barriers. The guards opened fire, but it was too late. The truck smashed through the doors of the headquarters building in which our Marines were sleeping and instantly exploded.
241 Americans were killed. Two days later, Marines led an invasion of the Caribbean island nation of Grenada. Communist forces were rebelling against the government there. Cuban soldiers were guarding the streets. President Reagan said he feared for the safety of American students at a medical school in Grenada. He sent the Marines to get them out safely. The Marines quickly defeated the communist forces. Many Americans were pleased. Others were angry. They said Grenada was invaded only to make people forget about what happened in Lebanon. The next year, 1984, was a presidential election year. It looked like no one could stop President Reagan. His warm way with people had made him hugely popular. He gained support with the military victory in Grenada. And by the time the campaign started, inflation was under control. The Republican Party renominated Ronald Reagan for president and George Bush for vice president. There were several candidates for the Democratic Party's nomination. One was the first African American to seek the presidency, Jesse Jackson. He was a Protestant clergyman and a longtime human rights activist. The candidate who finally won the nomination was Walter Mondale. He had been a senator and had served as vice president under President Jimmy Carter. The vice presidential candidate was Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro. It was the first time a major party in the United States had nominated a woman for national office.
Tonight, the daughter of working Americans tells all Americans that the future is within our reach if we're willing to reach for it.
One issue in the election campaign was taxes. Political candidates often try to avoid talking about taxes with voters. But former Vice President Mondale did talk about the issue. He said taxes would have to be raised to pay for new government programs.
The American people will have to pay Mr. Reagan's bills. The budget will be squeezed. Taxes will go up, and anyone who says they won't is not telling the truth to the American people.
This was a serious political mistake. President Reagan gained even more support as a result. The two candidates agreed to debate on television. During one debate, President Reagan looked old and tired. He did not seem sure of his answers. Yet his popularity was not damaged. On Election Day, he won 59% of the popular vote. On Inauguration Day, the weather was bitterly cold in Washington. All inaugural activities, including the swearing-in ceremony, were held inside. President Reagan's first term began with an attempt on his life. 6 months after his second term began, he faced another threat. Doctors discovered and removed a large growth from his colon. The growth was cancerous. The president was 74 years old. Yet once again, he quickly regained his strength and returned to work. For years, the United States had accused Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi of supporting international terrorist groups. It said he provided them with weapons and a safe place for their headquarters. In January 1986, the United States announced economic actions against Libya. Then it began military training exercises near the Libyan coast. Libya said the Americans were violating its territory and fired missiles at them. The Americans fired back, sinking two ships. On April 5th, a bomb destroyed a dance club in West Berlin. An American soldier and another person were killed. The United States said Libya was responsible. President Reagan ordered a bombing raid on the Libyan cities of Tripoli and Benghazi. Muammar Gaddafi escaped unharmed, but said his adopted daughter was killed. Some Americans said the raid was cruel. Others praised it. President Reagan said the United States did what it had to do. The president also wanted to intervene in Nicaragua. About 15,000 rebel troops, called Contras, were fighting the country's communist government. President Reagan asked for military aid for the Contras. Congress rejected the request. In fact, it banned all aid to the Contras. At that same time, Muslim extremists in Lebanon seized several Americans. The Reagan administration looked for ways to gain the release of the hostages. It decided to sell missiles and missile parts to Iran in exchange for Iran's help. After the sale, Iran told the extremists in Lebanon to release a few American hostages. Not long after, serious charges became public. Reports said that money from the sale of arms to Iran was used to aid the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Several members of the Reagan administration resigned. It appeared that some had violated the law. President Reagan said he regretted what had happened, but he said he had not known about it. Investigations and court trials of those involved continued into the 1990s. Several people were found guilty of illegal activities or of lying to Congress. No one went to jail. Most Americans did not blame the president for the actions of others in his administration. They still supported him and his policies. They especially supported his efforts to deal with the Soviet Union. At the beginning of his first term, President Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire. To protect the United States against the Soviets, he increased military spending to the highest level in American history. Then, in 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union. Reagan and Gorbachev held 4 summit meetings in Geneva, Switzerland, Reykjavik, Iceland, Washington, and Moscow. Each leader agreed to destroy hundreds of nuclear missiles. President Reagan also urged General Secretary Gorbachev to become more democratic. He spoke about the Berlin Wall, which communists had built to prevent citizens from crossing between East and West Berlin.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
About this time, a new sense of glasnost, or openness, was beginning in the Soviet Union. It was also a time of perestroika, or restructuring.
The American economy grew rapidly while Ronald Reagan was president. Yet at the end of his presidency, many Americans were concerned by what he left behind. Increased military spending, together with tax cuts, had made the national debt huge. The United States owed hundreds of billions of dollars. The debt would be a political issue for presidents to come, and remains so today. Yet Ronald Reagan will be remembered as one of America's most popular presidents. Above his burial place at the Reagan Library in California are these words, which speak to Reagan's belief in humanity. I know in my heart that man is good, that what is right will always eventually triumph, and there is purpose and worth to each and every life. Next Sunday on Learning English, we will look at life in the United States in the 1970s and 80s. This Making of a Nation program was written by David Jarmul, Steve Ember, and Geraldine Watson. It was presented and produced by Steve Ember, and we thank them all. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to longer versions of the stories that you have just heard on this program. You can also read, listen to, and download our other programs. And you will find captioned videos and lessons to test your American English skills. We'd like to hear from you. Send us an email. Our address is learningenglish@voanews.com. You can also send us a message through our website. Please know that however you reach us, we do read every message you send. You can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, iTunes, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel, all at VOA Learning English. And be sure to listen to VOA World News at the beginning of every hour, Universal Time, every day of the year. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you, and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow
for another Learning English program from The Voice of America.